Good afternoon. This is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, April 11th, 2019. Ahead this hour, the men's and women's NCAA championship golf tournaments are coming to the Blessings Course in Fayetteville this spring, and we'll hear more about how the tournaments landed in Northwest Arkansas for the first time ever on today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Later today on KUAF, it's NPR's Here and Now. As the world's largest democracy gears up for over a month of polling, India's Election Commission has blocked the release of a biopic about the prime minister in advance of the vote. And Facebook has had to take down material linked to his party and the main opposition party due to disinformation. Social media and the vote in India. Here and Now, today at 1, after Ozarks at Large on 91.3 KUAF. Temple Live in Fort Smith puts up the movie screen tonight for its Cocktails and Classics series. This evening, Sarah Crane steals some money, drives across Arizona, gets tired, checks into the Bates Motel. Spoiler alert, she doesn't check out. Psycho, the 1960 thriller, will be shown tonight. Doors at 6:30, movie at 7 at Temple Live on 11th in downtown Fort Smith. This is Ozarks at Large. Habitat for Humanity Benton County is coordinating their first Women Build volunteer home construction crew this year. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, women and girls ages 16 and up will undergo orientation and basic skills training.
Habitat for Humanity Benton County Restore, which as its name implies, sells new and donated home construction materials and household items. Inside the loading dock, staffer Hugh Thomas preps a newly donated item for resale.
I work at Restore and I'm just cleaning up this grill to put out onto the shop floor to sell.
Liz Dempsey, Restore Assistant Manager, says 90% of donated materials and items received are turned around and sold to support the cause.
This is where we take in all of the donations that the community gives, and all the money goes back into the community to build homes for members of the community.
Habitat for Humanity, an international nonprofit Christian organization established in 1976, partners with low-income prospective homeowner families to build brand new affordable housing for them. Habitat organizations operate in all 50 states, 16 in Arkansas. Megan Tucker is volunteer coordinator for Habitat Benton County.
Our office staff is located at the nonprofit center. Our volunteers vary greatly. We have Restore volunteers on a regular basis, and then we have construction volunteers, food volunteers, fundraising volunteers, family selection committee, our board members are volunteers. So to put a number on it, I would say well over 300 people on our contact list that volunteer with us.
Habitat Benton County currently operates on a $500,000 budget, says Liz Dempsey.
Our annual budget is about $500,000. That's how much the Restore raises every year, and that is entirely our budget. There are 7 Restore staff, and then there is 5 office staff.
Volunteers with future homeowners collaborate to construct homes coordinated by contractors Mike Sivak and Philip Fink. Again, Megan Tucker.
We will teach anybody anything they need to know. We do still contract out for plumbing and electrical, things that need licensed work to do. So we're not going to have a volunteer do the more critical parts of a build, but they do like the painting, they help put up the siding, they do the yard work, put down the flooring, all that stuff.
Liz Dempsey says Habitat Benton County builds, on average, 4 homes a year.
We have built 73 homes in the past 17 years in Benton County alone.
Habitat Benton County owns Habitat Housing Developments in Rogers and Gravett, but also builds homes on purchased individual plots, including in Pea Ridge. Tucker solicits volunteers by posting events on Facebook and through community networking, and homeowners also pitch in.
Because it's not just about putting them into a house, but we want them to get passionate about the mission as well and to work on houses. Like our current homeowner, Tina Reeves, she just got her home, just got the keys to her home, and we will definitely see her on next builds because she is so passionate about this.
A special selection committee carefully vets homeowner applicants.
So homeowners have to put in 400 hours of sweat equity. That counts as their down payment. They also still have to pay their mortgage, but it's an interest-free mortgage with Habitat. So we act as the bank in that instance. And so they do have to work to build their own home, and then they also have to continue to pay us. And those mortgage payments we use to also help build future houses.
Tucker says volunteer construction crews skew 60% male, so more Habitat organizations are proactively recruiting women for Women Build events. This year, Habitat Benton County is launching its first Women Build program.
Yes, April 22nd at 11:30, we'll be having a volunteer orientation at the Nonprofit Center in Rogers. So I invite everybody out there, come and sit down and learn what it's like to volunteer for Habitat. We'll talk about restore volunteering, construction volunteering, and then talk about the build schedule and more about fundraising and how to get involved.
Women will also learn about Habitat's mission. Liz Dempsey says all volunteers must comply with Federal Occupational Safety Hazard Administration rules.
Volunteers do have to sign a waiver whenever they show up on the construction site, and that's more so for insurance. We don't actually expect anything bad to happen to people because we are OSHA regulated. We try to make sure that there's no tripping hazards, head banging hazards. Everyone wears a construction or a hard hat whenever it is necessary. Everyone has to wear closed-toed shoes, appropriate clothing, just to ensure the safety of the site.
Volunteer women construction crews will also be asked to help raise funds for Habitat Benton County's affordable housing mission by soliciting sponsors or staging fundraising events. Major donors to Habitat Benton County are J.B. Hunt, Walmart, Johnson & Johnson, Meeks & Lowe's. The Northwest Arkansas chapter of Women in Construction also plan to pitch in on the Women Build. The orientation and training costs nothing, but women 16 years or older are encouraged to register for the Habitat Benton County Women Build program so trainers can be prepared. Megan Tucker says the rewards are worth it.
The rewards that come with construction volunteering is a new skill set. They'll learn basic carpentry skills like hammering, framing, nail removal, tool recognition, learn how to read blueprints, and power tools. And then you get to meet people from other community, like from the community, from other jobs. I mean, it's a great place to network and to connect and make true connections. And you'll get to meet the Habitat families and see who you're helping. So it warms the heart. It's you learn something new and it's challenging.
The first Women Build Habitat House project will break ground in either late April or early May, permits depending. And of course, men are welcome to join the crew. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To register or for more information on Habitat for Humanity Benton County Women Build, you can visit them on Facebook. Ahead on our show, what do civilians not understand about military law?
For the military justice system is that it's unfair. Right. So it turns out that it's actually pretty similar to the civilian system. It's fair in a lot of ways. Everybody gets a defense counsel. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor.
A legal scholar visiting the University of Arkansas talks to us about the differences and similarities between civilian and military courtrooms. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large. The city of Bentonville continues to grow in both population and building permits, according to an annual development report for 2018. Planning Services Manager Shelley Kerr says that's not much of a surprise.
For the last 5 to 7 years, we've been having pretty considerable growth. That's continuing, so that's what was expected. We thought at some point things might kind of level off a little bit, and they haven't. They're continuing. The rate of increase is about the same every year. That part isn't really changing much, but it's continuing to trend upward.
According to the report, the number of building permits issued in 2018 up by 11% from 2017, and the total valuation of all those permits nearly $500 million, an increase of 25% from the previous year. While single-family construction saw growth, Kerr says, it was a record year for multifamily developments, which made up 45% of all residential units completed in 2018.
I do think that for years, we just did not have much in the way of a variety of housing options, especially in regards to like multifamily type of housing units. And I think it was a means of trying to catch up with a demand Because it sounds like they're, you know, they're building them pretty quick and they're filling them pretty quick. So there is a need for it out there.
Construction also began on more than 16.5 million square feet of new commercial space, and 46 new projects were completed. That's an increase of 59% from 2017. Kerr says alterations and additions to existing buildings made up most all of the commercial building permits.
And this kind of goes across to residential as well. The thing that we noticed the biggest increase was in remodels and additions. So we're seeing a lot of renovation activity on both the residential and commercial sides. Both of those kind of spiked this year.
Kerr says most of the residential and commercial development is happening in the downtown area and in the southwest part of Bentonville. The report also tracks population growth. It puts the number of people living in Bentonville at more than 49,600.
We estimate population every year based on the number of housing units that are closed out that previous year. Those numbers were just a little bit up. We've been averaging about a 3%. We went up to 4% increase last year. So as far as our population goes, so we're continuing to increase at a little faster pace.
Gathering all this information year over year helps the city monitor development trends and plan for future needs. Kerr says the data is used to make decisions about infrastructure like roads, water, and sewer to make sure the city's services keep up with growth.
And then also, a lot of these numbers play a role into, library, their expansion needs, increasing, people in the community is going to put an increased demand on their services. And the same with parks and recreation as well. So we work very closely with all those other departments with our information so that they're aware of what's coming down the road.
This is Ozarks at Large.
Apple Seeds and Brightwater, a center for the study of food, presents Spring Brunch on the Farm fundraiser, Sunday, April 14th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Guests at the Apple Seeds Teaching Farm in Fayetteville will be served cocktails and a locally sourced spring buffet prepared by Brightwater students. Silent auction items and garden tours will be available. AppleSeedsNWA.org for tickets and information.
State of the Art will premiere Friday, April 26th at 8 p.m. on the Arkansas Education Television Network, AETN. Viewers can meet seven of the under-recognized contemporary artists found on an exhilarating year-long journey for a groundbreaking exhibition at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. State of the Art on AETN, Friday, April 26th at 8 p.m., aetn.org for more information. The Arkansas Razorback softball team beginning a 9-game homestand in a very positive way, taking both games from Wichita State last night at Bogle Park. A 3-game series against Furman begins in Fayetteville Saturday. If you were waiting until tomorrow for the John McDonnell Invitational track meet to begin in Fayetteville, don't. Because of rain in the weekend forecast, that meet has now been moved up 24 hours and actually begins today. And in case you missed it, the latest U.S. News and World Report list of best places to live in the United States is out. Fayetteville fourth this year, behind only Austin, Denver, and Colorado Springs. Over the course of a semester, the University of Arkansas School of Law hosts several visiting legal scholars to discuss any number of topics related to the law and legal education. On our program just this semester, we've heard from experts in everything from property law to providing counseling to help law students. A recent visitor in the speaker exchange, Eric Carpenter, was on campus to discuss military law. An associate professor of law at Florida International University, Carpenter has been both a prosecutor and defender in the military judicial system. During his visit here, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. He says there are several misconceptions about the military judicial system.
For the military justice system is that it's unfair, right? So it turns out that it's actually pretty similar to the civilian system. It's fair in a lot of ways. Everybody gets a defense counsel. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. You get a defense counsel. They're well-trained. The defense counsel aren't overloaded with cases, so they actually have time to work on your case, as opposed to in a lot of cities, the defense counsel might have 200 or 300 cases. They might talk to their client like once. And in the military justice system, your defense counsel is really going to be working hard on your case. So it turns out that's really fair. And I tell a lot of people that if I was innocent, I would much rather be in the military justice system because it's pretty accurate. That might not be a good thing if you're guilty, right? Because they're going to figure out that you are guilty and probably convict you. but it's a fair, just system. And the differences that are in the system tend not to be anything that should cause people to be spooked about it.
Yeah. Are there any procedural differences? I mean, I'm sure there are some.
The number one thing is that a prosecutor or a career prosecutor is not the person making the prosecutorial decision in a case. It's still the unit commander. Right? So the ultimate decision about whether to send a case to a court-martial is up to somebody that's not a lawyer. Right? They're going to be just a really high-ranking officer. And that's an area that's still under criticism from Congress and others. But they make that decision with a senior attorney giving them advice on what to do in the case. But that's unique. And then the other thing that's really unique about the military system is the jurors are hand-selected by that convening authority, by the general officer. So the person that's deciding to send a case to trial is also the one that's hand-selecting jurors. And you don't see that in the civilian community, right? It's you're entitled to a trial by the jurors or by your peers. And so they gather up a bunch of people from the community, and that's who your case is tried in front of. So that's not the case in the military. And those are the two most fundamental differences.
To people on the outside, they might hear that and go, wait, a hand-picked jury? That sounds like a deck could be stacked.
It could be. There's a bunch of protections in place. There are pretty good voir dire rules, mm-hmm. which are rules about how you can question the jurors and whether the military judge should grant challenges for cause, which are all pretty good. But it turns out that the people that are selected – and I was a defense counsel for 4 years, so I could have come into this with the panels were terrible. But it turns out that they take their job seriously. They do it without influence from the commander. They look hard at the cases. They quit. They come back with light sentences sometimes. And I've never actually seen a case where a panel has come back and done something that I thought was outrageous, right? So my client might have thought it was outrageous, but, you know, the kind of neutral person to me would say, that's actually a fairly accurate result and the punishment's not normatively out of whack. So it turns out they're still pretty fair. It just the process looks kind of odd, but it's really not an unfair system.
I guess another difference is you as the defense attorney, you're getting paid the same no matter what.
I mean,
your payday does not depend on how well it goes for your client.
Correct. And the defense bar in the military comes from the JAG Corps. Right? So they're getting paid the same as the prosecutors, and you go back and forth. So you might be – I was a prosecutor for a year. Mm-hmm. Then I went and got another law degree, and then I was a defense counsel for 4 years. And you can kind of – you can go back and forth. There's it has equal status in the system. You're getting the same amount of pay. And the pay in the military for the uniformed attorneys is actually higher than it would be in most civilian justice systems. So it turns out to be a pretty fair arrangement.
When you're an attorney in this situation in the military, is that your sole job?
It depends on the service.
Okay.
But for the most part, it is. Army, Navy, Air Force, you're going to be a judge advocate, and that's pretty much all you're going to do. And you're going to rotate within different jobs every couple of years. So you might do criminal law, and you might go do administrative law or operational law, like law of war kind of stuff. The Marine Corps, you can technically go out and be a regular line officer, but they still tend to do nothing but kind of JAG work for their careers. But it's principally what you do.
When you're in that role, are you defending, prosecuting any number of sort of things? It could be from theft to sexual assault to you name it?
Yep. So we try to start people off with the easier cases, but that's not always what comes up first. So when I was a supervising defense counsel, once one of my subordinate defense counsel, his first case was a contested rape case, which is kind of unusual, right? Usually out in the civilian world, you've got to work your way up from misdemeanor bench trials to something else until you finally graduate up to the felony trials. So they come much more quickly. The complex cases come much more quickly in a JAG's career, but they also have the best training possible, right? So the training that JAG's get, particularly in the Army but in all the services, is top-notch. It's as good as any in the country, and they're well-supervised. So though we may be giving them complex cases to start with, they've got a lot of people guiding them along the way. It's not just throwing them into the ocean and seeing if they can swim.
I think one reason that
there probably isn't as much understanding about military judicial system as one. Almost all of us have had some sort of civilian experience, right? Either whether we're fortunate enough to be in a courtroom or be part of the jury selection or know someone. Not everyone has been on that side.
Correct. And now the percentage of people that are in the military as a part of our population is down about 1%. Mm-hmm. So now it turns out that the biggest moments of reform in the military justice system have been after large amounts of people have been exposed to it. So like after World War II, that's when we scrapped the old system and got the new system because a bunch of people went through what back then was an extraordinarily unfair system. They came back and everyone can vote and their parents can vote. So they scrapped that system. And then during Vietnam, when we had another huge mobilization, people saw things that were unfair in the system, and there was another big moment of reform. So it tends to be that when lots of people are exposed to it, we get reform movements about the odd things. And those two big reform movements are what made the system much more of like kind of a civilianized system so that the differences don't really are hard to notice. I mean, people are wearing uniforms in a courts martial, but other than that, you could jump into one of those and they look pretty standard. And the current reform movement is much more about victims of sexual assault who have come together and said, this part of the system still is not working correctly, and they've been able to gather some political power and make another batch of reforms, which is what we're currently undergoing in the military justice system. And the odd thing is in the other reform movements were much more about that the system is really unfair towards the accused or the person that's been charged with an offense, with the idea that commanders are just railroading people and that it's the system is just unfair for the accused. This current reform movement is about commanders not doing enough, right, so that they're not prosecuting enough. And we've got a movement to give more victim protections, particularly for that class of victims who've been the victim of a sexual assault, and actually making it and trying to find ways to make it almost easier to prosecute a class of offenders. So we're actually seeing things swing the other direction towards maybe the accused have gotten too many rights in the military and we want to scale back on some of those.
When reform happens, you mentioned that it might be initiated by people who are part of the accusatory class. Mm-hmm. I don't know legal terms, but how does it have to happen? Who do you finally have to influence to have reform happen? Who are the decision makers?
Ultimately, it's Congress. Mm-hmm. So when the military knows that, so the UCMJ was written by Congress. Congress is charged by the Constitution with doing that work. When Congress gets fed up with the Department of Defense saying we're going to fix things and then things aren't fixed, that's when Congress gets involved. And that's traditionally doesn't happen very often. DOD will see that there's a problem, or Department of Defense will see that there's a problem, go in and make the fixes, and then Congress kind of backs away. But in the 2000s, Congress was not seeing the Department of Defense making the reforms that thought it ought to make. And that's when they came in and made a bunch of changes. And those changes have been happening since about 2007 all the way up until there's a huge act passed in 2016 called the Military Justice Act, which was, you know, as big a moment as we saw after World War II and during Vietnam in terms of changing things. Because Congress got fed up waiting, hearing the Department of Defense saying, we're making changes, and then they weren't seeing any results. So I expect we're going to go through a little period when Congress will be like, okay, let's see what happens. Let's let the dust settle. And if they're still not satisfied with results, then I think we might see reform in terms of actually getting at the last two kind of things that are left in the military justice system that are unique, which is the commanders running it and commanders picking panels. That's about the last – all that's left.
That is
– yeah. That's really, really unique to the military. There's small differences that don't really matter. You know, but I think if we don't see significant a significant difference in particularly how sexual assault cases are processed, that those things might be taken out in another 5 or 6 years. And so we'll kind of see what if these reforms have had any impact or not, and then see what Congress does. But Congress is ultimately the one that makes the changes.
And I guess as over time the military changes demographically and things like that, you have to examine how this works.
And I was giving a talk earlier about that there probably has always been a problem of sexual assault in the military once their integration started up in full force. And we're still sort of even in that process. The certain branches of the Army or certain jobs that were in the Army and in the Marine Corps were segregated still until very recently. So we're going to go through another moment of really fully integrating the all the services. The Marine Corps, they may still be, or they may be on the way out of having segregated basic courses, right, mm-hmm. where the women are doing training in one part of the base and the men are doing training on the other. And so we're still in the process of just getting people fully integrated. I think eventually once everyone's fully integrated, they understand the value that everyone's bringing to the table. There'll be more of a kind of a movement in terms of treating all the sexual assault cases as seriously as any other kind of assault on any other service member.
And then, of course, beyond the courts, I mean, the goal, right, is to have just fewer sexual assaults.
Yeah.
I mean, deal with it before it ever becomes an issue in a court.
Correct. And that's actually one of the punchlines from some of my research is we're doing a lot of tinkering with law and policy, trying to get after holding offenders accountable. Because there's three things they're really trying to do. They're trying to prevent sexual assault in the first place, take care of victims if there is a sexual assault, and then also hold victims accountable. Most of the attention has been on how do we hold the offenders accountable. The military has done a lot of good work on how to take care of victims. And they're probably leading the country. I'm certain they're leading the country on how to take care of victims once there's been an assault. The military is still not particularly good on direct, and Congress also, in terms of directing energy towards prevention. And they could spend, you know, cents on the dollar on the front end with certain security measures that would make it so that it's much more difficult to commit a sexual assault, at least on base or something. And if you prevent that sexual assault, then you don't have to spend the hundreds of dollars afterwards, you know, prosecuting that case. Very minor things like, so on bases, there are things that are essentially like dorms, we call them barracks. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those don't have very basic physical security measures in them, like security cameras or swipe card access or even a real security guard, not another soldier kind of watching who's coming in and out, but an actual independent security guard. And if we had those things, it would probably serve as a deterrent to committing a sexual assault in a barracks. But it's also great for gathering evidence. So, right, if the case does pop up, well, now we know who's been in and out of rooms because we have swipe cards. We know who's been up and down the hallway because we've got the video cameras and people logging in and out. We can see the state of a victim, like just how intoxicated she was compared to how intoxicated the accused was as they're walking up and down the hallway. And so we're ignoring some of that, and I think spending the money where in that phase where we could get a lot of good results, and we're still kind of wrapped up just focusing in on what happens if there is an assault. And some of my research has been showing that, and the research I am working on right now is showing that changing the law and doing those sorts of things really doesn't have an impact on case processing anyway, in any event, because the belief systems that might cause a case to drop out of being prosecuted can still wiggle their way into other parts of the law. So it could be that the very best things that we can be doing spending money is, I call it debiasing, but training commanders and law enforcement officials and other people in the military justice system the realities behind sexual assault so they can spot it in the cases they're working, and spending money on prevention efforts rather than just, you know, trying to find some new area in the law to tinker with.
Eric Carpenter is an associate professor of law at Florida International University in Miami and was recently on the University of Arkansas campus to speak at the School of Law. This is Ozarks at Large.
For the Central Arkansas Library System and KUAR, I'm Mark Criss with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. Actor-comedian-turned-evangelist Joe Jeffers brought turmoil to Jonesboro's Baptist community, leading to brawls, gunfights, and a fatal shooting. Jeffers held a tent revival in June 1930 that led to a schism in Jonesboro's First Baptist Church as some members sought to make him pastor. He returned for another revival in 1931, causing such mayhem that the National Guard was sent to Jonesboro to restore order. The traveling preacher returned in 1933 and sought control of a new Baptist church, leading to two separate congregations holding services in the same church at the same time. A court ruling against Jeffers gave control of the church to Pastor Dale Crowley, but a shootout as he sought to take possession led to the death of a Jeffers supporter. As Crowley awaited trial for murder, someone tried to machine gun him in his jail cell. He was acquitted, Jeffers left town, and the Jonesboro church wars ended, though bad feelings lingered for years. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
Well, we have made it into the middle of April. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Lee Wood, who is the host and producer of the KUAF Final Hour, heard Saturday evenings at 5 on 91.3, Sunday evenings at 5 on KUAF 3. Welcome back, Lee.
Thanks for having me. I can't believe that it's the middle of April already.
Yeah.
Time just keeps going.
It does.
There's a new show coming up on Saturday. Would you like to hear about it?
I would.
It's really interesting to me because my co-host, Robert Bishop, came and did a show, maybe 6 months ago, 4 to 6 months ago, because he was leaving, he's moving.
Oh, I remember this, yes.
Yeah. So then he came back for a visit, and while he was here, he said, "Hey, I brought some records. You want to get together?" I said, "Yes." So these are records from Oregon.
Where he now lives.
Where he now lives, and a lot of newly acquired records, and a really interesting mix. So he brought them here to share them, which I love, and also to share the story of this fantastic record store in Portland, Oregon.
Of course.
Robert lives in Eugene, but he visits Portland often, and it's called Mississippi Records. Have you ever heard of this record
No.
store? I hadn't heard of it either before Robert told me about it. So, record store, it's small, mm-hmm. small little record store, doesn't sell anything online. Really, I don't think it has an online presence at all. But they put out their own records as well as having other, mostly vintage. The new stuff that they carry is mostly things that they put out. Compilations of rarely found, mostly like soul singles mm-hmm. or folk and like country blues. Comps, but they often they're sort of loosely themed, and there's really great information about the artists. They put together a great package, but no real reason why. It's just almost like
these are great songs to put on a record.
Yeah, and as they find them, they keep putting things out. So we listened to some things that he got there. Blind Owl Wilson. Do you know who this person mm-hmm. is? Lead singer of a band called Canned Heat.
Hmm.
You remember? And can you voice?
Yes. And of course, there's that ubiquitous song that's used in like Geico motorcycle
yes,
commercials.
That's true.
Yes.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
But he has such a unique voice. Mm-hmm. So we listened to a solo song by him. And then George Mukabe, who's this really great African guitarist and singer. And again, the last time Robert was here, he played palm wine guitar, and loves that kind of music. And then we listened to just really kind of a smorgasbord of singles from these compilations from Mississippi Records. And it's, you can't get them online. I was looking at these beautiful records thinking, I gotta go to Portland.
All right. The KUA Final Hour, Saturday evening at 5 on 91.3, Sunday evening at 5 on KUAF 3. Lee, thank you very much. Waitress, the national touring musical at Walton Arts Center through Sunday afternoon, is set in a small town and addresses small town life's cozy comforts, but also its fishbowl challenges. Yesterday, two members of the cast of Waitress, Christine Dwyer and Stephen Good, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Christine, who plays Jenna, the lead character, grew up in Lynnfield, Massachusetts, a small town. Stephen, who plays romantic interest for Jenna, grew up in Gilroy, California, a small but growing town. I asked both of them if growing up in small towns, before they moved to New York and got work on Broadway, helped inform them for their roles in Waitress.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I grew up in a small town. I worked at the local ice cream shop, and everyone knew everyone. I mean, I graduated high school with less than 100 people, I think. So, it very much is a part of me to kind of understand where Jenna's coming from, where she's in that diner every day. The same patrons come in every single day. Everyone knows your business. Mm-hmm. You can't escape it. And I think that that's a huge part of this character and a huge part of my show. And I just happened to grow up that way too, where it's like, people would walk into the ice cream shop every single day. And if I was having a bad day, I had to put on a good face mm-hmm. because I knew all of them and they worked with my parents and they, it's cool to be a part of something like that that feels very much like how I grew up, even though I didn't grow up in the South.
Gilroy, California, what was that like growing up?
Yeah, it was pretty small town as well. Yeah. We had one high school. Yeah. I guess I'm trying to relate to it like you did. You know, I didn't really work in a diner or anything, but, you know, I was on the sports team, like in the choirs and the bands and all of it. And yeah, it's a small, tight community. Yeah.
And I think one thing Waitrose does well is it presents the positive aspects of a small town.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of us who have grown up in a small town, it presents the challenges as well.
For sure.
Right. Some things never change is in the first yeah. number, which is like, oh, the same day, but you got to do it, you know?
Yeah.
We'll do it all till we do it again.
Yep.
The next day.
Yep. And what's cool about that, too, is, you know, we start the show like that and then end the show with a song called Everything Changes, which, you know, it's essentially what I was talking about before, where it's never too late to change your life. And even if you are part of a small town, even if you do feel stuck, you don't have to stay stuck. And I think what our show does really well is it motivates people to kind of get out and do the things that they want to do and create the life that they want to create for themselves, regardless of where they're from.
They never leave the small town. You know, they don't really make big changes in a way that you think, like, I'm trapped. I need to, like, move to another town. I need to, like, you know, like, change some things about my family. Or, you know, it's small perspective ways that are the most potent changes in this production.
Don't you think that both of you can relate to that because you have grabbed on to something that was a dream? You say you saw Cinderella at a young age and wanted to do that. In high school, you discovered acting, and here you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I feel so fortunate to have had parents who supported this crazy dream. But now that I'm actually doing it, it doesn't seem so crazy because, you know, at the time when I was living in a small town, Broadway seemed so far away. And now that it's been there, it's again, you're jumping from one small community to another small community. You know, the Broadway community is pretty small, to be honest. And we do all know each other and we do all support each other. And it feels very much like coming from a small town because at the end of the day, you jump into this dream and you're with a bunch of other people who have the same dream and you're all fighting for the same thing and supporting each other in that same way, which is really cool.
There's a theme in this story about, are you happy? I'm happy enough.
Mm.
And Stephen, it used to would have been called stalking, but now in the digital age, just looking at your Twitter feed or Facebook feed, it's not stalking anymore. You put it out there for public. But I love how it seems like everywhere you go, you soak up wherever you are, whether it's Florida. You're determined not to be just happy enough on this tour.
Oh, not at all. I mean, it's such a great, it can be draining, you know, not having a day off, traveling on your one day off, but it's also a tremendous opportunity. I mean, I'd never been to Florida before. I've never been to Arkansas before. I've never been to, you know, to so many of these places, to Tennessee, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You've been on the tour life for years and years and years.
I've been on tour for like my entire life, I feel like. Although I've never been here.
And I have one last question for you. What's it like to fly? Because it looks scary as hell.
Oh, in Wicked?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I don't know. I did it for so long that it doesn't seem scary anymore. But the first time I remember going up into that lift all the lights were on in the theater, and I went up and saw just how high up I was. Mm-hmm. And you're standing on this tiny little platform that doesn't feel like it should really be able to support you at all. So the first time was definitely terrifying, and then it kind of became normal.
Okay.
But I bet if I were to do it again, it would probably freak me out a little bit again, because it is really high up.
Christine Dwyer, who did fly in Wicked on Broadway, stays on the ground in Waitrose at the Walton Arts Center. We also heard from Stephen Good. Waitrose is on stage at Walton Arts Center through Sunday afternoon. You can find out more at waltonartscenter.org.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. The days are dwindling down until Tyson Foods chairman Johnny Tyson realizes a long-awaited vision. Tyson is the owner of the Blessings Golf Club in Johnson. It opened 15 years ago, and next month will host a major amateur tournament with live television coverage. We'll check in with Tyson as the big event approaches. Plus, we'll have a rundown of other business headlines from around the region this week. That's straight ahead today on this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report here on Ozarks at Large.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology. With opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at onecom.com. That's one-comm.com.
In May, the University of Arkansas will host the NCAA Division I Men's and Women's Golf Championships at Blessings Golf Club in Johnson, just outside Fayetteville. The two tournaments are scheduled May 17th through the 22nd for the women and May 24th through 29th for the men, with the bulk of the action being televised live by Golf Channel. The NCAA Championship is the most significant tournament ever hosted by Blessings, which opened in 2004 and is owned by Tyson Foods chairman Johnny Tyson. Bringing such a prestigious event to his golf club, with a national television audience to boot, has been a goal for Tyson. Blessings was announced 2 years ago as the host course for the tournament, and preparations have been continuing ever since to make sure the course is in the best shape of its young life to welcome both players and patrons. During a media day event at the golf course on Tuesday, I spoke with Tyson about hosting the NCAA championship and how he's feeling now that the event is just a few weeks away. Spoiler alert, he's a bit nervous.
And I say nervous because making sure all the experiences for both the kids and for the fans, so the things that go on behind the scene, to make sure the ability to get in and out of the facility is easy, to make sure, you know, the food trucks are in the right place, you know, the restrooms are in the right place, the parking's in the right way. When people say, wow, that was easy, I got to park, I walked in, I got to see the event, I got to participate. So it's a form of hassle-free. And then, you know, as long as we have our manners for following the golf game, you know, the Golf Channel people are speaking to it, there's going to be no ropes. So you as a fan can walk behind the player. You can walk with the player. You know, you'll be able to stand and see the shot. It's not like you got to stand on the sidelines and watch. You're on the course with them. And I think that'll be a different experience for the fans. But for me, giving back to the game of golf, it's been important to me. I've got so many friendships. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, why did I name the golf course Blessings? And when we were putting it together, there were a lot of recommendations, oak trees, walnut trees, creeks. But it became very clear to me that with my faith and stuff, it kind of said, why don't you just call the golf course Blessings? And I kind of went, well, why? And it was, well, the blessings of being outside, the blessings to be with your friends, the blessings to walk in nature, and the blessings to play the great game of golf. So I think we're really blessed to be able to host the NCAA championships.
Where does your interest and your love and your passion for the game of golf come from? Were you a little boy? Were you a teenager? When did you get introduced to the sport of golf to get your passion flowing?
Summer times at the old Springdale golf course, when it was a 9-hole golf course out there on 71, you'd go over there and just go out there all day, hit golf balls, chase around, and just be with my friends and stuff like that. And, of course, at that time, you know, I was 8 or 9, there was a guy named R.H. Sykes. R.H. Sykes.
Former Razorback.
Former Razorback, won the NCAA championship, was one of the first introductions. Labor and Harris came over here. Miller Barber, so there were some people that were playing pretty good golf, but R.H. was a Springdale guy and would be out at the golf course. So that knowledge of the game being beyond But I've traveled with my friends many places to play, and it's a pretty special place.
What has the reaction and from the Blessings membership been here to putting the best foot forward for everybody, knowing that you're about to be on national television for a couple of weeks, and the golf community at large is going to have a front row seat to their golf course here?
I think, like a lot of members that like a lot of clubs that host an event, you know, there's going to be a lot of analysis going on upstairs. Oh, they're on the wrong side of the green. Watch this three putt. Or they hit it on the wrong side of the fairway. They need to hit it over here. So I think our members are excited that their knowledge will be able to say, yep, they're on the wrong side of the green. This is getting ready to be a three putt. Watch this one happen. Because they've been there themselves. So their knowledge makes it personal to them. But they've been gracious in the time that the golf course has been going through the adjustment. My members have been very supportive. They've been very patient, and they're excited to be the host members.
Right, and speaking of gracious, you and your family made the announcement here today, your commitment to the fan experience to this tournament, underwriting the admission fee for both the women's and the men's tournament. That's a very important part of this whole event, is it not?
Well, it's free. Bring your family. And then, of course, the other thing that our friends up at the LPGA put out is that the individual winner of the women's NCAA gets a full exemption into the LPGA event, and that's never been done. So there are really two firsts for NCAA golf: free admission, and that an exemption for the individual winner on the women's side gets in an LPGA event, and it's just wonderful. Yeah.
How is John Tyson going to watch these two tournaments? On the course, in the cart, on your feet, in the clubhouse, a little bit of both? How are you anticipating taking in these events?
Well, the challenge has been from the coaches and from Richard and my friends, are you going to watch the tournament, or are you going to be involved in running the tournament? And they say, Johnny, you should be involved in watching the tournament because you've been involved in setting it up. Go enjoy it. My kids will say, no way, Dad.
Yeah, you've put the work in. Enjoy the fruits of your labor, right?
Yeah, my kids will say, that won't happen, Dad.
And that's Johnny Tyson, owner of the Blessings Golf Club and chairman of Tyson Foods. You can find more information on the upcoming NCAA Men's and Women's Golf Championships at NCAAGolf19.com. Earlier this week, Arvest Bank announced the hiring of former Walmart executive Latricia Hill Chandler as the company's new diversity and inclusion officer. Hill Chandler most recently served as a senior manager for diversity and inclusion development at Walmart. Among other responsibilities, she created strategy and implemented the company's new inclusive leadership initiative, a company-wide diversity and inclusion effort focused on increasing inclusion awareness through education and training for Walmart's global leaders and associates. At Arvest, she will be the primary subject matter expert and developer of the company's diversity and inclusion and cross-cultural relations plans and programs. She has served in similar positions for Indianapolis Public Schools and the Central Indiana Educational Service Center and Indiana University. For more details about that story and others, be sure and visit our website at nwabusinessjournal.com. where you'll find our reporting on regional and state business news each and every day. That's all the time we have. We'll be back Sunday morning with another Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report on the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. Until then, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
Contributors this Thursday included Jacqueline Froelich, Antoinette Grajeda, and Susanna Sitek, who provided data and sound about Bentonville's growth. Timothy Dennis mastered our show today. Paul Gatling and the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report come to us through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics, and the Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute with Mark Crist is provided through the Central Arkansas Library System and KUAR, our public radio friends in Little Rock. Thanks to Lee Wood for coming by. You can hear the KUAF Vinyl Hour Saturday evening at 5 on 91.3, Sunday evening at 5 on KUAF3. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, and this is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF 91.3, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Mulberry. More news and information from around our region tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30 with Antoinette Grajeda's newscast on KUAF.
All right, let's end this Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large with music from the Boss Tweeds, recorded just for us at the Carver Center for Public Radio. They will play the George's Majestic Lounge Happy Hour on Dixon Street tomorrow night. This is their song, Rattlesnake. Avoid the pollen if you can. Have a great rest of your Thursday. Thanks so much for listening. We're back tomorrow at noon and 7 with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. All your luck and you're bound and you're stuck. She comes walking through the door like the answer to your prayers. Well, she takes what she wants. She burns and she haunts your dreams at night like a ghost coming down the stairs. Well, she's a bona fide, beautiful, big mistake. Don't look her in the eye, she's a rattlesnake. A rattlesnake. Well, she's gone when you're there. When you bleed, she don't care. She got a million different ways to make you feel alright. She got diamonds and pearls. She spins and she twirls. She dumps your soul till you never even feel the bite. Well, she'll carve you up like a T-bone steak and take a little taste. She's a rattlesnake. Rattlesnake. If there's one thing that you should know, taking my venom is the way to go. It'll weigh you down like a ball and chain till the poison hits your veins. Rattles.